I remember the day I quit being Catholic.
But yeah, so when I was about 10 years old, having had Christmas up to then Christmas went away.
Every now and again, before church, before the procession, I would sing the Ave Maria. And there were always a few little ladies in the front row that I could get a couple of tears out of.
So cheap.
I am. But you know what? Fame is fame. Even small fame is worth something.
And let me tell you, it basically was a doomsday cult.
I've not been Catholic longer than I was Catholic at this point. I miss the music. I like it. And it informs more of my songwriting than anything else.
Sabbath was on Saturday, and like I said, we didn't celebrate Christmas or Easter. Christmas was taught to be pagan, so it was definitely its own denomination within the evangelical thing.
It was kind of a pageant. I mean, the priest puts on vestments. I mean, he gets up in his pretty vestments and walks down the aisle, flanked by two altar boys. It's drag. Again, it's like we're both talking about a Christian tradition, but my upbringing in church could not have been more different.
For today's installment of the Religious Historian podcast, we'll look at traditional religion through the lens of experience, specifically the experience of leaving it. Religious disaffiliation. Can you ever really leave? What are the motivations for pulling away from one's family tradition? What are the fallouts associated with doing so, and how does this affect the view of religion more broadly? Do formerly religious people become more or less spiritual over time, and do they replace religion with something else? We'll hear from two individuals of very different upbringings, one Catholic and one evangelical Protestant, both born and raised in the so-called Bible Belt of the American South, both independent recording artists, both members of the LGBT community, both my good friends, Wayne Fischel and Keith Miller, who, in the music world, goes by Big Peaches. Wayne hails from coastal South Carolina, Big Peaches from the Appalachian Hills of West Virginia. I've been lucky enough to call these two guys friends for the last decade of my life, and was thrilled when they agreed to be a part of today's discussion.
I was realizing yesterday that in this discussion that we're about to have, you and I are actually, because my parents are from Appalachia, we're both part of the Appalachian diaspora.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
You could say your religious upbringing was strongly influenced by your environment.
Well, yeah,
because I was Catholic, heavy in Little Maryland.
Yeah.
And same for me because it came to, my mom through the radio.
Wait, do you mean she listened to like the evangelical talk shows of the age, and that's where, like, was there a local church, or was that her connection?
That was her connection. I mean, there were local churches, and still are, but quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to the radio is such a big part of the culture. And this guy who started this church, he started doing his whole, dog and pony show in the 30s, mm-hmm. like 1932. And by the time it got to reach my mom's ears, it was 1969, over the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a weekly broadcast,
mm-hmm.
So it was like a whole show, a radio show for a half an hour or an hour, just preaching fire and brimstone or whatever. I can remember hearing my grandparents listening to those over the radio.
Mm. Do you remember the person's name that from 32 that started that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Garner Ted Armstrong. I did something I've never done before, and that is really to go, I went to the Google and looked up this church and this man, and let me tell you, it basically was a doomsday cult.
Oh.
So I've discovered that my mother was in a doomsday cult.
Wow.
So much. It was called the Worldwide Church of God, Garner Ted Armstrong.
All right.
That's what it became. It changed names a few times. That's what it became around 1968.
Huh.
And then the church split again in like 1986. I think that's when he passed away, and there was a schism in the church, and that's when it kind of went away from my mom's life, and that's when Christmas came back for me.
Was the radio the cohesive sort of agent in your community, or was it like you also went someplace?
We also went about having to drive about 30 miles, which, you know, coming out of the holler, coming out of the rural woods and, you know, going down and going up the river, and going over the thing, up the mountain, 30 miles to church mm-hmm. on Saturdays, you know, which was just fucked, right? You know, as when you're a kid, that's just so fucked. Yeah, so where there were about, I can remember, you know, 25 to 30 people who who attended, and it just seemed to go on forever. It was almost all day Saturday.
Yeah.
And everyone carried a briefcase.
A briefcase?
Yeah. My mom had a black, like a businessman's flat, you know, like briefcase.
What was in it?
It clicked open. It had, you know, Bible and notepad and pens, and everybody had these things and took notes copiously. And yeah, and that was church.
I want to know just what was the sermon like? What happened?
I can't really remember, just from a kid's perspective of old white man up there talking about hell.
What more do you need to know?
I guess so. Okay.
Yeah. Endlessly for hours, pacing back and forth. Yeah.
Huh.
Nothing, no snake handling, no, nothing bursting into flame or people being healed or none of that stuff. It was very antiseptic and very boring for my active mind. I wish something dramatic could happen. But now that I know it's a doomsday cult, I'm glad it did.
I've not been Catholic longer than I was Catholic at this point. There's so much pomp and circumstance in Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like, Keith, I feel like you were raised with a great deal of orthodoxy, but very little structure. Where I had the absolute opposite, where I was raised Catholic, which is full of structure, but American Catholics and Catholics in general do not tend to be, even if you're super orthodox, it's not the same as the sort of evangelical movement. I knew every week when I went to church, with the exception of a couple feast days that there might be something in the middle that was different, I knew exactly what was going to happen in church, right? We were all going to stand up and sing a song, and while we were singing said song, the priest and his entourage were going to walk down the aisle, and it was kind of a pageant. I mean, the priest puts on vestments. I mean, he gets up in his pretty vestments and walks down the aisle, flanked by two altar boys. It's drag. It's total drag. It's total drag. But so, like, we knew we were going to church, but church was just sort of this thing that happened. Like, I feel like Catholics, as a general rule in the States, you know, and it's even more lax in Europe, I mean, it's sort of a passive belief, much more about, okay, you go, you do these things. It was sort of like a checklist. Mm-hmm. And then by the time I was in high school, I mean, I was an active participant because that was my weekly show. because I was a cantor. So, and cantoring in the Catholic Church is different than, like, a cantor in a Jewish synagogue. In the synagogue, the cantor is very much a centerpiece of the service and everything, and sings a great deal. There's a basic structure to the Mass, the song, the procession in, there's some prayers, someone gets up and reads a reading from the Old Testament, then the cantor gets up, and then there is a psalm, and it's any one of the psalms. It's all divided by year. There's regular time and Lent and Christmas and Advent, and the year is very regimented, but everything is cyclical. You are going to do the same thing next year at this time that you did last year at this time. And so the cantor gets up and the cantor sings the refrain from the psalm, and then you raise your arm up high and you ask the congregation to join you, and everybody sings the refrain, and then the cantor sings the rest of the stuff with the refrain brought back in, everybody's singing. Then there's a reading from the New Testament, but not the Gospel. And then we have some prayers, and then there is the reading of the Gospel that the priest does. And then he has what's called the homily. Catholics don't use the word sermon. There is no one gets a sermon in a Catholic Mass. It is a homily. If the priest talks longer than 15 minutes, we're all looking at our watches. Like, this, we didn't come here for this. We have there are things to do. Again, it's like we're both talking about a Christian tradition, but my upbringing in church could not have been more different.
You know? Go back to where you got to sing the song. What?
Oh,
what happened? Like, were you looking forward to that every week? Was that like?
Of course, I was looking forward to that every week. What do you think, Julia Carroll? That was my show. And what would happen is every now and again, before church, before the procession, I would sing the Ave Maria, and there were always a few little ladies in the front row that I could get a couple tears out of.
I am,
but you know what? Fame is fame. Even small fame is worth something.
Did you miss it, or was the natural progression to become a songwriter?
Well, I mean, it's very funny because I remember the day I quit being Catholic. It was my freshman year of college, and I had somehow found my way to some booze, and I was a little hungover, and it was Sunday morning, and I think I had tried a couple of the Catholic churches around Columbia, but there was one right downtown that I could walk to. And I'd gotten up and I probably went to like the 10:30 or the 10 because I could sleep in a little bit. And I got into church And the homily started. Again, that's our word for sermon. We never say sermon. It's the homily.
Shh. Don't say it.
Don't say sermon. There are really some words. The Catholics go, what? I don't know what that is. No one preaches in a Catholic church. There's no preaching. You get a homily, and then we're going to say some prayers that you could say in your sleep. Yeah, because you've said them every day of your life.
See, that's all that I got was preaching.
Yeah.
Wall to wall. Yeah, that was all it was.
Which has to be exhausting.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there, and the homily does start, and something had to, one of the readings, I don't know, New Testament, Old Testament, Gospel, I don't know. It had to do about paying lip service. And the priest said something in his homily along the lines of, if it's just lip service, why bother? And I just felt something click in my brain and go, oh yeah, this is just lip service. And I got up in the middle of the homily and I walked out. Now, that was not the end of my time in the Catholic Church, because when I went back for summers, I was basically the choir director for the Spanish Mass during the summers at the church that I went to, because the priest had lived in Mexico for a while, spoke Spanish, and there was a burgeoning Hispanic population in Horry and Georgetown counties and the surrounding counties in North Carolina, and he offered a Spanish Mass. So I would come on Sundays and do that. And I was involved in that, but I wasn't really, at that point, I was pretty convinced this was just a show for me. But I remember the lip service thing going, yeah, I don't believe this. Or at least it was the seed of I don't believe this. I don't know about you, Keith, but is there still a sliver of you that goes, oh, but what if they're right?
No.
Okay.
No, not even a sliver. No. No, and I mean, you were dealing with, the monolith that is Catholicism.
Right.
So, yeah, and it's still everywhere you go. And for me, when I left it, air quotes, but that basically happened just naturally when I moved to New York City, when I left, the rural of West Virginia. So when I left it behind. And, but it did continue to play into my life, because I never went home for Christmas, for instance, for years. So made my life go in a certain direction. So there's that. It still had its influence, but it wasn't all around me all the time, like, crucifixes and Catholicism and stuff. I just wasn't hearing about it anymore. So it just kind of receded until the holidays came around.
Well, I don't know if, Keith, for you, there was a moment, like for Wayne, but the idea of, like, leaving that and whether or not you actually ever do, it sounds like Wayne, I mean, and for what I know of you anyway, like, implicitly kind of you're saying that maybe it never leaves you, really? But Keith, obviously.
No.
Yeah.
It never leaves you. The way, and I think you'd agree, Juliet, but I don't know your, childhood upbringing story related to this, but I think you'd agree that, yeah, however, whatever it is we're taught as kids, it never leaves you fully.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, in the religious sense, because they're going, here's what you need to believe. Believe it, believe. And so you're like, okay. And it's still there in many ways. Never leaves.
Wayne, would you agree, like, for you that's true, given that...
Well, Okay, so one of the things that, it's not that we were never told to believe, because, well, your parents believed this, and your grandparents believed this, and your great-grandparents believed this, and your great-great-grandparents believed this. Like, I sat through the same church service in a different language, but the same exact church service that had been sat through for hundreds and hundreds, well, thousands of years by the time I was born. Nearly 2,000 years, you know, I was born late in Catholicism.
Yeah, and for me it was like 1934.
Right,
you know, I mean, come on. It's very new. It's quite new.
Right, and it was, Keith, I wonder, like, we didn't know anybody that changed their religion. Like, where my parents came from, religion was baked in, at least with the people that they knew, but they knew all Catholics. Mm.
Yeah, and all around, my mom could have chosen Methodists or Baptists or just the Christian church, go down to the Christian church, or, you know, Presbyterian, you know, so many choices. So that's a good question of why. I know she didn't like gossip. I remember her talking about she didn't like the people who went to the church, and she didn't like the way they gossiped about each other.
Well, that's admirable.
So she was in search of something else. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And let me say, Julia Carroll, I have never actually spoken to Keith's mom, but we have interacted in ways. She is quite genuinely the sweetest person on the planet. The most genuine, loving, caring person on the planet.
Not a death cultist.
No.
Really, just not at all. She really is. She's just so real in her pursuit of the faith, her faith. And it's very strong. You can see it in her, and it works for her, so.
Mm-hmm. But if it works for her, then, like, I guess, you know, what's the harm, right?
Right. Right. I guess. I don't know. I haven't drilled. I did kind of drill down with it in a lot of therapy. But I think that was the conclusion. Mm-hmm. Overall, really, no irreparable harm, really. I was going to tell you that something Wayne said, I can't remember what it was, he said so much.
I'm so sorry, you know how I am.
But when, it was hard enough, and then when I, like my mom told me about, you know, Christmas when I was like 10, like I said, and but then becoming a teenager, and it was hard enough being in a gay teenager in Appalachia, but then my mom is in this weird doomsday cult, so I had that extra layer. Like, the fact that my family did not celebrate Christmas made me feel so weird, and I did everything I could possibly do to hide that fact. That was my reason for living, was hiding that fact. And my mom would, like, you know, forbid me to go to Christmas parties, or, you know, we couldn't have one Christmas carol playing in the house, or one light or one candle or just nothing. So it was just not being, like, being different. I was different from everyone else in that respect. And my mom demanded, you know, that in her house things be a certain way. And so I just couldn't really join in on the joy of the Christmas season. And to this day, it affects the way I have Christmas. I was living in LA, and it was 1996 or whatever, and this is after that church has dissolved, and my mom and dad have started going to the Methodist church, and my dad got born again, and then, you know, they were doing that whole thing, and it was near Christmas, and I was in LA, and with, again, no plans to go east, and it was a box, yeah, from my mom, and it was covered in Christmas seals. Do you know what Christmas seals are?
Yeah. Like the stickers? Like the stickers?
Yes. Yeah. It used to be like charity donation, and you give to Christmas seals, and you get these stickers to put on your mail. Uh-huh. And it was covered in them, yeah, and... So it was a Christmas package from my mom. The first one I had had since I was 10.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, and it was delivered, and I, you know, had this big, like, vestibule thing in this house I lived in L.A., and I just put the box there in the floor, and I just left it there for days. And I would just stare at it and walk around it and stare at it. And I finally opened it. It was... just little gifts and things and Merry Christmas. And then I was talking to my dad on the phone, and my dad had happily for years gone along with it because mm-hmm. he didn't have to spend money or do shit, you know, or do anything. So, and I said to him, is it, well, I got this box. I was like, is Christmas on? I mean, 1 year it's off and now it's on. Is it like a light switch and that you can just switch on and off? And my dad basically told me to get over it and get on with it. And I was like, all right, got it, I'm on board. And
crazy.
So then I did have a period while that I went when I lived in Atlanta, for instance. The whole time I lived in Atlanta, I spent almost every Christmas with my family.
Mm.
And it kind of healed a lot of that stuff, actually.
Wayne, you said you, like, you aren't, you know, well, you're not a part of it, but I'm curious about the fact that you recorded the album that you did a few years ago for the funeral.
My Catholic funeral.
Yeah, right. And
I
so when yeah, I was thinking about this project...
It was my weekly show. I was in the folk group, so I was an active participant in the mass. Once the Second Vatican Council happened and the structures opened up and softened, and people could have the liturgy in their own language, and all of this kind of stuff happened, things got very loosey-goosey in the American Catholic tradition. But one of the beautiful things that happened was that in the 70s, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there was this explosion of Catholic songwriters who were writing for the Mass, because for Protestants, everything was always done in the mother tongue. Whatever it was that you spoke, you were going to church and you were hearing your language. Well, that didn't happen for the Catholics. And so by the time English became an official language of the Catholic Church, an English-speaking country, that was the 50s. And so we didn't have songs, but we knew that in the church service, there are songs. Protestants already had their songs, so we didn't adopt them because they weren't ours. Yes, every now and again we sang Amazing Grace, but very rarely. Mm-hmm. You know, we had, so most of a lot of the songs on that album that I recorded, you know, they really speak to a generation of American Catholics.
Titled Fare Thee Well.
Fare Thee Well.
On iTunes.
Yeah. Thank you, Big Teacher. But the thing is, it's one of the things that I actually miss. I actually like the music. I genuinely like it. It was always very soothing, if well sung. A lot of them were very grating.
It was a gift for your mom.
The CD was a gift from my mom because I had already recorded two of my own music, one that I don't speak of, but I, for the purposes of this podcast, I will acknowledge that I recorded the first CD. And after the first CD, a lot of people in my family, because I became the family funeral singer, I refused to sing at weddings after a while. I was like, I don't get to get married. I'm not coming and singing and participating in a religious service as an active participant in a club that won't have me. But to me, a funeral was different. A funeral is about, we've just lost somebody. If someone gets some sort of peace or, you know, comfort from these songs, and a lot of people, like, we really do, like, we start hearing these songs, and they matter to us. We sang them our entire lives, you know? And then, like, the Ave Maria, I mean, that is, like, Catholic anthem right there. Yeah. You know, that brings the house down.
Maria Grazia Plena.
You won't find anyone who's Catholic, or very few, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. No. Evangelicals don't like Catholics.
Yeah. So I've heard.
Isn't that true, Wayne? Is that true?
Well, that was true.
They are. They do find common ground. For instance, against us.
Yeah. Yeah.
They certainly do.
Yeah. You know, when I realized that, you know, at one point, the leading authority on Judaism in Israel and the leading Palestinian mullah, the only thing that they could agree on was that gay people were gross. Mm.
Yeah. And you Julia, I would say. Like the positive thing for me, it is sort of the opposite again of Wayne's positive. And the positive I got out of it, and I told my mom and dad this, was that they accidentally taught me that there are different ways to believe. You can choose to do it differently. You don't have to go do it the way anyone does. It's what's right for you. So I learned that. I was like, Mom, you taught me that. And I choose none. So, and that none is an option. Uh-huh. You know, so that opened me up to the idea of maybe going, oh, looking into that. So I looked at it all, and I was into it all. And in the 80s, I was into crystals and channeling and, you know, everything, tried everything. And so I was like, no, it's all bullshit. You know, just be.
Yeah.
So that was the positive for me, being opened up to a world of possibilities.
Filling the void with any other types of religion, is that something that you've... Or something that's not traditionally religious. For some people, it's music. For others, it's, you know, art or whatever. But, like, do you have something that you would say is, like, kind of ritualistic and similar? Or have you had no need to fill a void that was left?
I would say no need. And I can't think of anything that like that. Mm-hmm. Not for me. Mm-hmm.
There is still, and there will always be, probably, a little bit of me that does still think, ooh, but what if they were right? And maybe that just comes from the structure of Catholicism, that, you know, everything is so structured that, like, this just sounds like, well, no matter how wacky it sounds, purgatory does sort of sound like a place. I did sort of feel like maybe there was something. I did try to be Wiccan for a while, but that only lasted like 5 minutes.
Why?
Well, I work well on my own if I'm given a task and instructions. but there just wasn't enough. It's weird because it's all, that Wicca is very much about symbolism and ritual and mm-hmm. all this kind of stuff. These things that I could easily latch onto. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, take away the crucifix. And a Catholic mass is kind of pagan. And, you know, that's, you know, why all these people started breaking away, because it was like, what's this show we're all doing? The NTR has filled the void. They have a couple really good shows, and one of them is On Being, where uh-huh. Krista Tippett talks a great deal to people from many faiths. And when I listen to shows like that, or when I read other people's experiences, it sort of scratches this sort of deep-seated need, but the more I've learned about life, the universe, all of this kind of stuff, it's like, if there is a God, an all-powerful thing, it is so beyond any human consciousness that it's ridiculous of me to try to understand or mold it into something that fits into my life. Mm-hmm. Maybe when I was younger, but not now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, for a while, just because I always remembered saying, and I still believe this, that theater became like the church for me. Mm-hmm. A theater, like a theater audience, when the audience is there and a play is on stage, that is a sacred space mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. It still is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even if the play sucks. You know, it's just like there's certain rules, there's certain way you act, we're here for a purpose, you know, and we're going to get through this together. And it's really the only thing that ever gave me that feeling of spirituality.
So if you had to define yourself as spiritual but not religious, would you? Or would you just say neither, but you find these things kind of spiritually engaging?
Spiritual but not religious. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wayne, same question.
I would say at this point in my life, neither. I don't, which makes me very sad in some ways, because then this really is it. There's this trip around the block, and then that's that. Mm-hmm. Lights out, folks. Mm-hmm. Which for me is the reason people sort of have religion, is it's a way to make you feel better about whatever clown car we're in on this planet
at the moment. Exactly.
Well, exactly. At ever.
Yeah. At any given moment.
Yeah. And but you know, I thought for a while that maybe I was spiritual, but I've kind of stopped believing that mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
But then again, I'm not yet in a foxhole. Maybe when I'm in a foxhole, things will look a little different.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, well, I will relieve you both. And
oh, my goodness. Julia, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for being some of my first guests ever.
Oh, I want to come back.
Yay.
Will you have us back? Will we come back to your show? I've loved it.
Please.
And talk issues. I mean, come on.
Yeah, let's do it.
Do you see a briefcase and you think about church?
It does trigger me. They do trigger me. You know, those, like, 1960s, hard side.
Yes.
You know, with the hard handle. Mad Men, sort of. Briefcase that clicks, has those double clicks open. I get kind of triggered. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.